My name is Charles, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here with you guys this morning. We spoke earlier about the video on, video off. The reason I want my video on is because I'm going to invite you this morning. You know how you tell the difference between bullshit and the truth when somebody's speaking? You look into their eyes. You look straight into their eyes. And that's what I want you to do this morning. I want you to look into my eyes. I want you to look straight into my eyes. And I want you to stop thinking and feel your gut. When you're listening to me, I want you to listen to your gut and feel what my words mean in your gut, not what they mean in your head. Not all alcoholics are like me. I know people who sobered up when they were 40 years old, 50 years old. They had normal, fairly normal childhoods, fairly normal lives. But somewhere along the line, later in life, they crossed the line and they became an alcoholic. And they developed the obsession and the compulsion. That's not my story. I was born into a very abusive situation, which turned me into somebody who needed to escape reality just to survive. That's how I became an alcoholic. Now, you probably noticed AA has changed a little bit over the last few years. Back in the old days, we didn't talk about this stuff. As a matter of fact, we were told, this is AA, please restrict your comments to how they affect your alcoholism or how, you know, about your drinking and your alcoholism. But with the advent of Zoom and the way things have changed over the last few years, more and more people are starting to talk about the real issues that made them turn into alcoholism. Childhood trauma, childhood abuse, neglect, all those things that shaped my personality, shaped my soul, shaped me to be somebody who did not want to be me. See, I drank because, and again, I'm only talking about me. I drank in the early days. I drank and did everything because I did not want to be in me. I did not want to be Charles. I did not want to live in my life. I didn't want to live in my body. I didn't want to live in my house. I didn't want to live. And that's why I became an alcoholic. But again, like I said, there are different kinds of alcoholics. And so if you can't relate to my story, don't consider my story the only story. I am just one type of person, one type of alcoholic, and this is my story. But I have no choice but to give you my truth, and this is my truth. And again, I'm going to touch on certain things as I go through. The Malaya has told me I've got 15 minutes to share 65 years of experience and 35 years of recovery. No problem. Let's get started, shall we? So I was born into a home with two parents, of course. My mother, very fucked up as a child. She came from a very bad place, very little education. Her mother died early. She went through a lot of different stuff, abuse and neglect and that kind of stuff. Came out of that home all screwed up. My father, he, again, raised in a very stern sort of disciplinary, and a lot of physical violence for discipline, that kind of stuff. But he sort of managed to cope. And in his early 20s, he found the love of his life. He married her. He had two children. When she was pregnant with her third child on the table, she died in childbirth. So he lost the love of his life and his third child in childbirth. But he still had two small children, 2 and 3 years old, to raise. My mother came up from a very small community outside St. John's looking for a job. He hired her as a housekeeper. She raised his two children. Shortly after, he got her knocked up. 9 months later, I came by. He was not a very patient man. After she came back from the hospital with me, he got her knocked up immediately again. My brother came along 10 months later. I guess he figured that, it was cheaper to marry her than to fire her, get rid of her and hire somebody else. That's how my early life started. So he had the two sons that she was raising. they were the love of his life. They were her Bess's boys, you know. And then the second family, me and my brother, and a little bit later, a couple of years later, another child, a girl came by. We were the housekeeper's bastards. So this is the situation that I was born into. I have found that the early story, that's more important than my drinking history. My drinking, you know, my drunkalogue. Everybody here knows how to drink. Everybody knows how to you know, to use drugs to escape reality. You don't need to hear all those details. But what I'm going to tell you now is going to sound a bit off, but as I swear, it's the absolute truth. And like I said, look into my eyes. I'm not going to tell you any lies this morning. I had my first full-blown blackout when I was 7 years old, but it wasn't on alcohol. It was on gasoline. When I was about six, I got into sniffing gasoline. When I was seven, I was in a basement with a can of gasoline, sniffing the gasoline, and I went into a blackout. My arms dropped, the can dropped, and all the gasoline spilled over the floor. Even at 7 years old, when I came out of this blackout in a few minutes, I looked around and I knew, even at 7 years old, I knew I was in deep shit, that if somebody flicked on a light switch or there was a spark, this whole basement would explode. I ran around, opened the windows, cleaned up the gasoline, and told my parents that I had spilled a can of gasoline. But that experience sort of saved me, because if I had kept on sniffing gasoline, I would have become one of those children from a reservation whose brain had so much brain damage. I was so scared by that experience, about knowing that I'd almost blown the house up, that I stopped sniffing gasoline. So that sort of saved me. I started using anything I could to escape from my home life. This is where it gets difficult, because this is where I start talking about childhood abuse. Have you ever heard the term covert narcissist personality disorder? That's is something that's becoming more common now. Basically, it's what it is somebody who's so fucked up that they hurt people and then tell lies about it. That's how they control people. They get pleasure from hurting people, and then they tell lies about it and keep it a big secret, and they control and manipulate people like that. My mother was one of those people. Now, I didn't know that back then. I just knew she was a very cruel and you know, sadistic person. But my mother started physical violence real early, when I was just an infant. As a matter of fact, I started biting my finger like that when I was a small child. And it was years later that before I understand what that was all about, I would be beaten until I was quiet. So in my early childhood, she would beat me, and she wouldn't stop unless I was quiet. So I would bite the flesh off my own fingers to keep from screaming. And when I was quiet, she'd stop beating me. And that turned into that of course was a coping mechanism, but that turned into something that went with me my whole life, because as a small child up to seven, I'm a program. I'm a computer that just records. I'm not a thing. So even as I grew up and even all through my life, right up until I was 50 years old, 60 years old, I would still bite my fingers whenever I get angry, whenever there's frustration. I mean, that was a coping mechanism that I learned as a small child. And that followed me my whole life. And it caused me shame my whole life, because you can just imagine being in the school and something would happen, or I'd be bullied. And I became this freak. And even when I was married, you know, my wife never understood that. My father, he wasn't an abuser in that way, but he was very violent, because what would happen was that he didn't want anything to do with us, the housekeeper's kids. He had his two sons that he loved. He knew he had to feed us and clothe us, but he didn't want to waste one second of his time on us. And he made sure that I knew that. Every time I looked in my father's face, I knew. I see it in his eyes that I was a piece of half-bishop garbage, and I was going to be a drunk and a failure, just like my mother's family and just like everybody in my mother's family. And I wasn't worth his time. And that's how I grew up from the first time my father ever touched me, he kicked me across the yard like a football for putting a hole through a piece of felt in the backyard. Now, he was the one that left a two-year-old child with a screwdriver in front of a piece of felt that he was going to put on the roof. But to him, it was the child's fault because he put a hole in the felt. That was the first time he ever touched me. The only time he ever touched me after that was with a leather belt or his hand. But here's the real damaging part. The physical abuse is not what did the damage. What did the real damage is that then he would look at me and tell me it was my own fault. He did it because I was a lazy youngster, or I was bad, or I had done something that deserved to be beaten for. And that's what did the real damage, because that's when I learned who I was. I learned that I wasn't as good as other people. I learned that there was something wrong with me. And that's the way I grew up. And that was my early childhood. I won't give you all the details, but I'll just give you an example. My mother would use manipulation and control. And when I did something she didn't like, I'd get a beating for it. And then she would tell people that, well, she had no choice, that, you know, these were bad youngsters. And the only way to control a bad youngster was with a wire cord. Do you guys have electric frying pans? You know, that wire cord is covered with rubber that you plug in an electric frying pan with. That was my mother's weapon of choice. That's how she used to control us. She'd take that, double it over twice, and she could get a good swing with that. And that's how I was disciplined. Good word, discipline, right? And then that's what she would use to control me. When I did something she didn't like, I'd get that. But here is the real damage, that then she'd tell me that it was my own fault, that she had no choice, that this I deserved this because I was a bad youngster. And see, I believed her. And I grew up, and even when I was in a man, those early programs, I believed that I was bad. I believed that I was lazy. I believed that there was something wrong with me, that I deserved to be beaten. When my father would get home, he'd come in, he'd be in a rage, and I didn't understand it, but she had told him that I'd done something, either steal money from her purse or told lies or did something. So I would get another beating from my father for doing something. And when I'd look at him and tell him no, that I didn't do that because I didn't, then I'd get another beating for being a liar. And then he'd look at me and let me know that I was a worthless, how could you lie about your mother? How could you tell lies? How could you be so vile? And I'd get another beating for lying about my mother. That's how I became an alcoholic. I became somebody who did not want to be me. I became somebody who did not want to live in this world. Now, I grew up like that, but fast forward now. So anywhere I could find a drink, I would sip drinks out of glasses that when they would have parties, they would have people in. I'd go down and after everybody went passed out and went to bed, and I'd drink whatever was left in the bottom of the glasses, you know, or left what was in the bottom of the beer bottles. The first time I got a sip of alcohol when I was 7 or 8 years old, I knew that that was my answer. And I tried everything I could to get as much as I could after that. I would be a small child and I would sneak down and I would go into the liquor cabinet and take a big glass and take just a little bit of rum, a little bit of vodka, a little bit of gin, a little bit of everything, put it in a glass, fill it up with apple juice and take it upstairs. And I would drink that and fall asleep. That went on until the bottle started to go down. Then I started to fill them up with water. When that happened, I got caught. Then my father went out and bought a steel frame and put it around the liquor cabinet with a big padlock on it to keep me out of it. That's where I learned how to pick locks. Fast forward, I managed, because I wasn't terribly stupid, I managed to just get through in school. I managed to get through, and I guess in a lot of cases, the teachers put me through, you know. I'd have 50s and 60s, but they put me ahead. And I sort of managed to get through school and managed to sort of survive this. But early school, again, I was a setup for bullies because I felt like a victim. I was a victim in my soul. So therefore, every time a bully looked at me, he knew that I was just there to be used. And that's what all the bullies always said. I was picked on by everybody because I was set up to be that. I was set up to be the victim. And I didn't understand that. See? And when a bully come at me, I did what all us victims do. I'd say, that's not fair. And I go and that would just give him more excuse to hit me more. And so that was a cycle that I went through my whole life, being a victim, being abused by people who enjoyed beating up or enjoyed violating victims. But I digress. Going forward, managed to get through school, managed to find a way to get accepted into a college. And that's when, but just to go back, drinking at 5 or 6 years, drinking at 8 or 9 years old, I got into drugs very early. I was doing speed when I was 14 years old because it was easier for me to buy speed, methamphetamine at our local university than it was to get alcohol. So I would get enough money together by doing whatever, odd jobs or whatever, and I would buy methamphetamine when I was 14 years old. And I would use that going to parties and whatever. I got in with a bad crowd. You know how we tend to get in with bad crowds? I got in with people and I had access to all kinds of drugs. I did a lot of speed. I did a lot of acid. Man, if I can't tell you how many times I flipped out on acid. Funny, after in recovery, I'll talk about hallucinogens in recovery later. But I'm a big advocate of using hallucinogenic drugs, DMT, psilocybin and acid for recovery as a recovery for depression, anxiety, and addiction. But that I'll talk about that later. Okay, fast forward. I met a girl. She, of course, because I was set up for a certain type of personality, I found a woman who was emotionally unavailable and who was pretty screwed up in her head. Excuse me, but I get a little emotional. Okay, before I talk about her, I'll talk about my first love. When I was around 18, 19 years old, I went to college and I met this beautiful young girl. And she was the person who saved my life, because I fell madly in love with her. And she loved me, truly loved me. And she saved me because she gave me reason to live. She gave me a reason to work. She gave me a reason to manage to get by in school. She gave me a reason to be in this world. And she saved my life. That her love and that first love was what saved my life. And that gave me just enough to keep going. Because if not, I was a person who always thought about suicide. When I was a small child, I thought about suicide all the time. But I managed to get through it. When I met her, she gave me just enough to give me the hope to keep going. But I was an alcoholic. I did things with her. I did things to her. That only lasted a few years. And I screwed that up. And I ended up leaving her because I wanted to drink and she wanted a life. But I will always thank her because she was the person who gave me enough love to just keep me going. After that, it became real bad. A lot of heavy drinking, a lot of failure. See, a lot of people talk about failing in AA. I was a failure because everything I tried in early life, I failed at because I had no ability to study or apply myself to stuff. So I just stumbled into jobs, whatever I could do to find money to keep going. But everything I failed out of or got quit out of or got fired out of. So in my soul, even when I got out of the home of, you know, home of origin, childhood family of origin, even when I got out of that, everything reinforced the fact that I was a failure because every job I had, I failed at. Everything I did, I failed at. I became a salesman because that's all I could do. When I was around 24, 25, I got into another relationship with a woman. She was a good woman again, but she didn't understand how sick I was. But she saw something in me. And I basically bottomed out to the point of where when I was around 25 years old, I made a fool of myself at her place one weekend over Christmas, and she just came to me. And actually, I remember this like it was yesterday. She said, "Charles," she said, "I love you, but I can't put up with this. There's alcoholism in my family. I know about this thing called AA and that. And there's a meeting next Sunday night. And if you ever want another blowjob from me, you're going to go to this meeting on Sunday night." She knew how to reach me. You know, bless her heart, she knew how to reach me. Sunday night, I was sitting in an AA meeting. And but it was an open AA meeting with Al-Anon. And so we went in there and we sat down at the table, and everybody, of course, identified me as the newcomer, and everybody went around the table and everybody told me about this this thing that they had, this thing called sobriety. Now, I had wanted nothing to do with it. I was only there because I figured it was easier to go to this damn meeting than it was to find another girlfriend. That's the only reason I was there. But even at that first meeting, I felt something subconsciously, something in my gut. I listened to people talk about the shame. I listened to people talk about feeling worthless. I listened to people talk about doing things like getting up every morning and peeking out through the drapes to see if the car was in the driveway. That reached me. Because see, that was me. That was my life. Every morning I'd have to peek out through the drapes to see if the car was in the driveway because I couldn't remember. My life was blackouts. Every day I had blackouts. Every time I drank, I had blackouts. That was my life. Now, even though I didn't stop right away then drinking, then there was some, that seed was planted. And I knew, even when I listened to these people, I knew that I was in the right place. This was the first time in my life I had ever found people who understood how I felt, who understood how I drank, who understood me. But again, I was a fucked up kid at 24 years old. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I kept drinking for a while. Lost that girl. A couple of years later, I did sober up. I finally went, and this time I went to a meeting because I was at the end of a suicide attempt, and I had nowhere else to go. It was either go to one of these AA meetings again or die. Crawled into this AA meeting, and again, I had that same thing. And here's the true story. This is amazing. First, I was, you know, coming off a tail end of a suicide attempt, went into this first AA meeting, sat in the back of the room so that nobody would see me. And I, you know, wanted desperately for the floor to open up and I could just fall in and just disappear. But I sat there in the back of the room. And there was another newcomer there, and he was half drunk. And halfway through the meeting, he got into this, oh, you know, I get to go on, you know, I can't go on, I need that, you know. And I, because he was doing that, everybody addressed their comments to him instead of me. So I could sit back and watch all this. And so I sat back and I listened to this guy and I listened to everybody talking to him and that. And you're never going to believe this, but it's true. After the meeting, I walked up to this guy and I stuck out my hand. And I said, don't worry, things are going to get better. That was my first meeting. And I have told this guy that, don't worry, things are going to get better. Because I felt it in my gut. That I was in the right place. When I got sober and went to traditional AA, it was not a good time for me. I'm an atheist, and I was always an atheist. And when I went to AA, I was not accepted with open arms. I was not, my viewpoint was not validated. I did not receive unconditional positive regard, unconditional positive acceptance. I was told that if I didn't get on my knees, I wouldn't get sober. If I didn't pray to God, I'd have no chance of getting sober in AA. But I needed you people. And I was lucky enough to find a few good people who took me under their wing and put up with my godlessness. That's where and my first sponsor was a woman, actually. It's frowned on today to do that, but it was even really frowned on to do that in the early 80s. I sobered up in 1984. But she took me in under her wing, and she was the second person who saved my life, because she would talk to me, and she would look into my eyes, and she would mirror to me that I was okay, and that I would get over all this alcoholism stuff. I would find a way to live, and I would find a way to be happy. And even though I didn't believe it, I believed her. I believed that she was telling me the truth. So I listened to her, and that's where I started to get my first real understanding of what recovery is all about. See, recovery for me is all about finding a way to be comfortable in my own skin. Recovery to me is not about finding a way to stay sober. To me, recovery is about a way to find a way to be comfortable being myself. If I'm okay being me, I don't need to drink. I don't need to use drugs. I don't need to use internet porn. I don't need to go shopping. I don't need to eat two pizzas and then a big chocolate bar. If I'm okay within me, then I don't need to escape being me. Early sobriety, I could tell you all about, going to meetings, beginning with people and all that kind of stuff. But you've been there. You know what early sobriety is like. Early sobriety is terrible. Because when you take away the anesthetic, all you're left with is the pain. And that's where I was in early sobriety. I was left with nothing but the pain. But this old lady, Barb Cody, and a few other good friends that, peers, people my own age that I made good friends with, they saved my life because they accepted me just as I was. And I learned that there was hope in here. There was hope in this AA thing, even though I had no belief in any kind of God. And I always hated those fucking character defects. I hate character defects. I don't believe in character defects. I'm not a defective person. I'm a sick person who needed help to get well. I'm not a defective person who needs help to be better, to be a good boy. So I always hated that character defect thing. Early sobriety, I'll just shoot forward. I stayed sober for 3 years, 4 years actually. I went back to college. Barb Cody and these people convinced me that I had a chance. I could actually do something with my life. I could become something. I went back to school. I studied naval architecture. I became a shipbuilder. I found, and what had saved me was I found something I loved. I love boats. I love ships. And so because of that, that was enough to overcome everything. And I actually graduated. And then I met this wonderful woman. This is where it gets funny. She was married twice before, not an alcoholic, but come from a very fucked up family. But she was one of these people who was really successful. She knew how to study. She knew how to pass exams. She had her PhD in psychology. She was a clinical psychologist, but as fucked up as a bag of hammers, right? Like most psychologists, like most professionals, she could talk a good game, but she was fucked up herself. But she saw me and she liked the idea of marrying a sober alcoholic because she didn't want some guy who was going to be drinking beer and watching sports. So my first sponsor, Barb Cody, introduced me to her. She was a good friend of hers. And Grace saw me as the perfect guy, somebody who wouldn't drink beer and watch sports. And also she had cancer, cervical cancer. The doctors told her that she had 6 months to have a child or that she'd have to have a hysterectomy. She latched onto me and I fell madly in love with her because she was a success. She was everything I ever always wanted to be. But here's what happened. She only had 6 months to have a child or she'd lose the chance. So of course, what did we do? We got married right away. After we'd been together for 6 months, we got married. I moved up to Halifax with her and I graduated. I finished school. That was just at the tail end of my college. Finished school, moved up to Halifax, a different city with her. Got a good job, a wonderful job in a shipyard. But I left all my support group from St. John's. Fuck, the time is really running on. I've gone over my 15 minutes. So I'm gonna give you the short version from here on. After 3 years, 4 years, I got drunk again because I got away from all my AA friends in St. John's. I got away from my sponsor in St. John's, and I got drunk again, even though I had everything. I had a new house, a new wife, a new job, a great career and all that. I got drunk because that little inner child came out. And when something happened one weekend, I got angry at her and I drank at her. You heard the old saying that the first time you get sober is a gift. The second time you have to work for. That's true. I got drunk and I would stay sober for a few months and I'd get drunk again. I'd stay sober for a few weeks. I'd get drunk again. I'd stay sober for a couple of months and I'd get drunk again. I desperately tried, but I couldn't get back to AA. I couldn't get sober again. It took me almost 2 years before I finally got sober again, but I did. I finally got sober. Today, I've been sober a little over 31 years continuously. I've been in recovery, like I said, about 35, 36 years, but I've been sober continuously 31 years. When I got sober a second time, I started getting into all kinds of recovery. I don't know if you guys remember a guy named John Bradshaw, the inner child stuff, all that working on your inner child thing. I took that to heart and I got into that and I got into meditation and I got into real recovery about finding out who I was. I got into all that stuff and you know, this is where we get into stuff like, I discovered that I had ADHD. You guys know what attention deficit is, right? Now I always had it, but at that time in the early 90s, it became fashionable. And so the doctors were starting to talk about it. And I went to a doctor and I got prescribed Ritalin, methylphenidate. You know what that is? It's speed basically, right? But I was prescribed. And so I started taking this stuff and I thought it was going to be a medicine, but I started taking my medicine with a glass of water. I ended up taking my medicine with a bill rolled up, you know, but when I started to abuse it like that, it took me a few months to get honest with myself, but I went back to my doctor and I told him the truth and I got off that stuff and I don't use anything now. And I haven't for years, what I really want to talk about, here's what the real recovery is all about. When I got sober the second time, I got serious about real recovery, about finding me. And I got into this inner child work. I got into real recovery. To me, that's like the fourth and fifth step in the program. To me, it's just a form of cognitive therapy. It's a form of dialectic therapy. The traditional AA people talk about the steps of you get your resentments and you find out who's you're angry at and all that stuff. To me, the fourth and fifth step were all about finding out, getting a piece of paper and a pen and writing down everything that made me feel angry. Everything that made me feel ashamed, everything that made me feel afraid, getting a handle on all the emotions that were keeping me in on that hamster wheel. And when I did the fifth step, look into another alcoholic's eyes and shared this stuff with another alcoholic, it's like lancing a boil. You know, if you have a boil that's infected, a doctor lances it and they squeeze out all that ugly stuff, and then the boil has a chance to heal. To me, that's what the fourth and fifth step is. When I looked into another alcoholic's eyes and vented, shared all these feelings, share it with another human being, I get rid of all that ugly stuff in my soul. And I squeeze out all that, the resentment, the hate, and the anger and the rage. I squeeze all that stuff out. And then my soul has a chance to heal. To me, that's what real recovery is all about. And to me, that's how the steps work for me. And I tailor the steps to give me what I need for real recovery. In other words, to find a way to get in touch with who I really am. Because that to me is, the truth shall set you free, but first it'll make you miserable. And that's what I needed to do. I needed to find the truth. I needed to find out why I drank. I needed to find out who I was. And I needed to find a way to be comfortable in this world. And recovery gave me that. I needed to be around other people. Now, Malaya, I've gone over 15 minutes. I need about another 5 minutes. Would that be okay? Okay. You guys all know the steps. You all know the AA program. Would you like to know the scientific basis for how the AA program works? Would you like to know how AA really fucking works? The research was done in Canada, out on the West Coast, in the University of Vancouver. The scientific experiments were called Rat Park. And what they did was they took rats, got them addicted to alcohol and drugs, and put them in little cages with a lever. And these rats would push this lever until exhaustion, and they would kill them. They would die just getting cocaine or alcohol. But then the researchers did a strange thing. They took these rats who were addicted to heroin, cocaine, alcohol, and they took them out of those little isolating cages with the little lever, and they put them into a big, comfortable thing with other rats where there were little places where they could go to sleep, and there were little wheels they could play, and there was lots of food, and they could meet other rat people, and they could have relationships, and they could have rat babies, and they could have a real life with. And guess what? These rats who were addicted to alcohol and to cocaine, they gave them access to alcohol, cocaine, and water. And you know what these rats went for? They went for the water. Even though they were addicted to cocaine and alcohol, when they were in Rat Park with other nice little rat people that who they could talk to and socialize with, they went to the water instead of the cocaine and the alcohol. And that's, but here's the thing, when they, and they had normal lives in their little rat park. But when they took these rats out of the of Rat Park and put them back in a little cage and isolated them away from other rats, those rats went right back to that behavior, pushing that little lever for alcohol and drugs. And they would do that until they died. And that's what I was. I was a rat who was isolated in my little cage. And that's what I believe all of us are. When we get abused or violated or whatever, we withdraw into ourselves and we don't have healthy relationships. We don't have connection with other people. And that to me is what alcoholism and what addiction is all about. It's about being isolated. And when I'm isolated, I will push that lever for the cocaine or for the alcohol or whatever until I die. But when you take me out of that isolation and put me in Rat Park with other rats, the rats here in AA, the rats in recovery, I make relationships. I look in people's eyes. I have friends. And then I don't need to escape anymore. Then I don't need the alcohol. Then I don't need the cocaine. And I can escape from that addiction. I can escape from the craving and the mental obsession. As long as I'm surrounded by you rats, I can escape from the obsession and the craving. And then I don't need other things in order to be okay. And that's what AA is to me. And that's what I believe AA really is. This is our rat park. This is where we find those connections with people. This is where we find that inner connection with life, with whatever, that gives us what we need to fill that empty hole, to stay away from drugs and alcohol, or you know, whatever your drug of choice is. That to me is what recovery is really all about, is finding that connection with people so that I don't need to escape myself anymore. And that's what AA gave me. Yeah, even traditional AA, it gave me that connection with people, that connection with other alcoholics. And that's what my recovery is all about. Now, I'll just clue this up. I told somebody here that I would talk about things. I would finish up by explaining what being an empath is all about and what being an advocate is all about. I've been sober a long time and I've been working on this a long time. I have found a meaning in my life. All that suffering that I went through, all my understanding about pain and alcoholism, I use that now and to try to help other people. And I got a gift out of all that suffering, and you did too. I don't know if you realize it yet, but you got a gift out of all that. All that suffering that you went through turned you into somebody who understands other people's pain. You can feel other people's suffering. You can feel other people's pain like no psychiatrist can, like no counselor can, like no psychologist can. I can understand. I can feel other people's suffering. I can feel other people's pain on a deeper level. And that's why I can connect with other people. And that's why I can offer them hope. And that's why I can help other people the way no professional can. And that's why you can help other people the way no professional can, because you have that gift of empathy, that deep understanding of what real suffering is all about. And that's how you reach other people, because you don't tell people how to get sober. You show people how you've got sober. I show people how I got sober. I let them look into my eyes and let them feel in their gut that I'm sober today, not because I have to be sober. I'm sober today because I like being me. I like being alive in this world. I like being able to be here and to experience this whole thing. The advocate part of it is that I've decided that I'm going to use all the suffering that I experienced in my life to try to help other people. And that gives me meaning today, that I reach out and try to help other people who are suffering. And that gives me a sense of peace, because all that misery I went through, there was a reason for it. I can use that now to help other people. I can use that now to reach you and to touch your inner child, to touch your soul, and to help you understand that you're not a bad person. You were just fucked up. Your environment fucked you up, and you need help to get unfucked. And that's what to recovery is to me. This is where I come to get unfucked. And folks, that's my 15 minutes.